examples this morning. And I want to start out talking about stuff that is written down. Okay? Books, whether it's fiction, nonfiction. Stories use words that are understood by the author and hopefully by the person who's reading it. That way the meaning is conveyed. But there's a bigger picture to it. The words often convey a lot more than just the words say. Now, this is kind of obvious, but think about it for a minute. I want to take the term Super Bowl Sunday. Okay? It's only three words. But what does that mean? What does that convey? What are the thoughts and feelings you have, good or bad, about Super Bowl Sunday?
That's idol worship, in my opinion.
Awesome. Okay. Idol worship.
A day to go to Disneyland?
That's right. You know the best 2 days to go to Disneyland? Mother's Day and Super Bowl Sunday. Okay. Anyway. So what feelings, thoughts, what do you have? What comes to mind when you hear the word Super Bowl Sunday?
Big event.
Big event.
A lot of beer.
So drinking. Al?
Alan. I didn't care less because I don't follow sports.
So, good. So it doesn't matter.
Expensive advertising.
Good.
Also time for social gathering.
Yes, very much. Social. Good. That's right. So if you are a football fan, more than a casual fan, you are going to care about the outcome. There's going to be, you may feel really good after the game, you may feel really bad after the game. Your team will be honored or your team will be shamed. What else?
4-7.
Big gatherings of friends.
Big gatherings of friends. How about money exchanging? I'm sure none of you do it, but a lot of people gamble on the Super Bowl. So it's an opportunity to spend some money. Jackie and Steve. Jackie!
Yes.
Shh. Good for you. All right, then you get up here and you finish. What's that?
Putting the needs information in the roster.
Oh, well, that's important. I know it is. Okay.
I'm trying.
You're trying or crying?
I'm crying.
You know? All right. Well, here's what I wrote down. Vindication or humiliation of my team, special event, celebration, party, social event, food, break the diet maybe, gambling, win or lose money, drinking, biggest sporting event of the year. Then you have to get into what is sports, why are sports so important, the feelings you might have, exultation, humiliation, relaxing, fun. It could be stressful if you're hosting the party. So all of these things that we just talked about are part of the package that comes with those three words, Super Bowl Sunday. Okay, so when you read Super Bowl Sunday, there's a meaning that is intended by the author and is conveyed to the reader with only three words, because they obviously mean the whole package. Okay? Does that make sense? We understand these details about Super Bowl Sunday. Why? Because we're part of the culture that the Super Bowl happens in. We grew up in it. It makes sense to us. We don't need to have them explained. That's why novels can be so rich. You read a book and you get way more out of the book than the simple words that are there, because you're infusing it with your own impressions, your own pictures in your mind, your own ideas about what the author is talking about. But none of those are in the phrase itself. That's the really cool thing about writing. You get all these pictures, it's sort of a shorthand. It's the same way when we read the Bible. Now, I've got an article I want to bring up out of the LA Times.
Oh, that's great. That's a great cosmic coincidence.
Who are you?
I'm from another planet. I've taken the form of one of your creatures. And we have been looking at an article. Is that what you're talking about to your creatures today?
Do you read minds too?
Well, no, not really, or else I wouldn't be needing to ask you these questions.
Wait.
You're the leader of this group, yes?
You have sunglasses on your planet?
I don't know. I just took this from the creature whose body I'm occupying.
Does that creature have a name?
I don't know. But I have questions for you. You're asking me too many questions. You're supposed to be the teacher.
Who's in charge here?
I'm trying to figure that out.
Oh.
Maybe you can help me, Mr. Leader.
What is your questions, Mr. Alien?
Well, my first question is, first, you have an article. What is your article?
A softer warning on Carmageddon 2.
That's the same one I have.
Amazing. How did that happen?
It must have been a cosmic coincidence. I uttered that when I came in and you didn't listen to me.
I get accused of that a lot.
Okay, my photon sensors aren't calibrated for this range, so hold on just a second.
You're not.
This is much better.
Glasses on another planet?
I'm on your planet. But my question is this. First, this is what looks like an article about something has to do with cars. It says Carmageddon 2. This is last year in the run-up to Carmageddon, officials were apocalyptic about a closure of a freeway. Were they running to the freeway?
Running to the freeway?
Yeah, it says it was a run-up to the Carmageddon.
Well, you can't...
What is Carmageddon?
You can't take it literally.
Well, what do you take it?
Well, you have to understand the meaning that's in the article.
Well, what does it mean? Why don't you just say what you mean instead of writing these strange sayings?
So that I don't have to talk as much as you're talking.
But you're the leader. You're supposed to talk less.
It's all yours.
Well... Okay, then you won't answer that one. It's obvious you do have problems with this, too.
Well, maybe the class can explain to you what you're looking for. So ask the class a question.
Let me do one that seems to be a little easier, because that one seems complicated for you. Well, maybe they can tell me. It says, last year in the run-up to Carmageddon. Where were they running? Where's Carmageddon?
Next to Ohio.
So Ohio is here, too?
Ohio. That's Alan. He's
one of those creatures.
He's humorous. Do you understand humor?
I don't know. Let's do one that's easier because you're going to have a problem. Down below it says, it will be an absolute nightmare. So do you have... Is this a dream or is this real?
Some people think it's a dream, yeah.
So it's just a dream?
No, it's not.
Armageddon is a dream,
that's
not a place? He said it was Ohio.
A nightmare is a figure of speech, you see. It means that people would have bad feelings about it.
Well, let's talk about
female horse running around at night.
How's that for confusion?
That is confusing. That's very confusing. You people have a problem. Our language is not this confused. Look, read this part here. It says, avoid the area like the plague, said Councilman Corretz. I did not know that your plagues could avoid areas. How do you do that?
No, it's a figure of speech. It means as you would avoid the plague, which is a big illness and a sickness, you should avoid this area. It's so obvious.
Well, why do you not just say avoid the area?
Well, it's not nearly...
What does it have to do with the plague?
To confuse aliens. It's not...
It worked.
Good.
It worked.
It's not nearly as interesting. You see, there's not... The plague, there's all these visions that you get in your head, all these ideas that are conveyed. If you just said the area, that's not interesting.
Well, you have a fixation on physical problems because there's another thing here. There's a cafe owner, Handel, said his customers are aware of the potential for congestion this weekend. Are they getting sick?
No, congestion means bad traffic.
Bad traffic.
How does congestion mean traffic?
Well,
is there traffic in his cafe?
Well, just like it means like when your nose is plugged up, the traffic's plugged up. You're not very creative.
Well, there's another part here that he said he predicts that many will stay out of their cars without heavy-handed warnings. And we are trying to calibrate that, too. We're trying to figure out how heavy does your hand have to be? Warned really well. What does that mean?
Well, Boy, you really don't understand.
No, I don't.
Heavy-handed means like if I was going to smack you for being an idiot,
mm-hmm.
that's a heavy-handed warning. You try to avoid that.
Here is another part of your problem language. Matt Corrigan of Sherman Oaks faked a dinner party on the empty freeway last summer for a photo that went viral. And we're trying to figure out how you can transform a photograph into a virus.
Well, again, you see, it's a word pick, it's a word play. Viral means like it spreads really fast.
So you convert the photo into something that goes fast?
Yeah, over the internet.
Okay, here's the last one, because you're not making any sense to me. There's a man who says his name is County Supervisor Yaroslavsky. He said, Carmageddon for the closure. Now, he's one of those trying to balance the carrot and the stick. And we're trying to figure out how it is that he's a doomsday prognosticator. Is that something you do with carrots and sticks, is prognosticate?
That's true. Carrot and stick means you hold the carrot out in front of the animal, and the closer he gets to it, the further he gets, the further he moves away from it. It's a word picture. It conveys all kinds of ideas that you don't have to describe literally. You must come from a really boring planet.
Sit over there and listen more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all. Okay, so what did we learn from Alien Mark there? There's a lot of stuff in anything we read. There's a lot of pictures in there. Everything that's intended isn't spelled out. Probably, 2%, 5% is spelled out. The rest is all pictures that we see in our mind. And the English language has lots of wordplay and puns.
Analogies.
And guess what?
Poetry.
The Bible does too. So if we don't have a really good understanding of the culture that the Bible is in, we're going to be limited in how we understand it. So what I did was I came up with three examples that I think are pretty cool ones. They're very specific about some specific verses that I had never heard before. And I think it really adds to my understanding of these verses. The first one has to do with sheep. So let's go to... The question is, why does Jesus use the analogy of sheep so often in referring to us as believers?
Because he made sheep to exactly show us our nature. Sheep are dumb. They fall down, they can't get up. If they get wet, they drown. A whole bunch of stuff.
Okay, what else?
Sheep are meek.
Sheep are followers.
Followers, meek, dumb. What else? Mark?
Yeah, it was a common thing then, very common. Sheep, shepherds, and so he could compare it to something that everyone knew about.
So the sheep were all over the culture. Everybody knew about sheep. Okay.
And they were cared for.
They were what?
Cared for.
They were cared for. That's good. That's getting close to where I'm going. Let's go through some verses, and let's look at what each of these verses say. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. What does that say about sheep?
Without a shepherd,
they wander off in their own direction. Of course, that's not true about me, but... Okay. 1 Peter 2:25, for you are like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your soul. So if the shepherd is around, what do?
Follow.
We follow. We know who the shepherd is. Okay. Still not there yet, though. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. What does this say about us as sheep?
Take care of
us. You need someone to take care of us.
That's right. In other words, we don't have to worry about stuff. I had, on a personal note, I had a horrible, disastrous week this week. I just went through a lot of personal, emotional stuff. This psalm really helped get me through. I read this over and over. It was a hard time for me. But the idea that God's in charge, I'm not. The things that are happening for a reason. That reason is a good reason. That God loves me. It made a huge difference to me. Leviticus 11. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hooves, and choose the cud that you may eat." So sheep is included in that. Sheep is an animal. What does this make sheep? It makes sheep valuable. Okay? Matthew 10:5. "These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go into the way of the Gentiles and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So again, the idea that sheep can get lost. Matthew 10:16. "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." What does this say about sheep? Tim?
Actually, what I wanted to say was an aside comment kind of reinforces some of this. We use these sheep, as you mentioned, the sheep analogy, as you mentioned, because it's something that we can all relate to and understand the characteristics of sheep. I remember a newsletter that our class member, Wes Ringer, sent from South Sudan to Bible translations. One of the difficulties he had with those translations is none of those people he's working with has ever seen a sheep and knows anything about them. So how do you translate this concept in the Bible into their language? And that's a similar kind of thing that we have in translating the ancient Hebrew into modern English, looking from a cultural perspective, exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's very good, because all of us, in going to church for years and years and years, we've learned a lot of these details about sheep. I'm coming to one that I think we haven't heard, which is going to be my point of this. But it has taken us a long time to learn about why God uses this analogy of sheep. But if we were in that Mediterranean culture in the first century, none of this would have to be explained. All of these analogies would be obvious with... You just say the word sheep, like we said Super Bowl Sunday, and all of these ideas come to mind about sheep. Al?
Why doesn't he want to go and spread the word to the Samaritans? Why was that?
At first.
I know they were Gentiles.
Yeah, at first his message was to the house of Israel, and then later it was go out to the ends of the earth.
So
that's right. "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." So what does this imply? There's a relationship there, right? Okay. Don?
With many of these, if you knew how a shepherd owns his sheep, you can understand this better, because the sheep will follow him. He can just wander along, and they'll come after him because they hear him talking to them.
Wherever he goes.
But if somebody else comes along, they'll just get it.
And it's sort of automatic, isn't it? He doesn't have to keep corralling them.
That's right.
He just goes. He'll take them to water or to food or to pasture or wherever, and they know enough at least to follow him. Yeah.
They know the tone. They know his voice, literally.
Right.
The voice of a stranger they would not follow.
Right. Moreover, 1 Chronicles 12:40. "Moreover, those who were near to them from as far away as Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali were bringing food on donkeys and camels, on mules and oxen, provisions of flour and cakes of figs and cakes of raisins, wine and oil and oxen and sheep abundantly, for there was joy in Israel." Sheep were important. Big commodity, like having lots of money, having lots of sheep. It was security in that. "Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering." So a sheep was a worthy sacrifice. Okay, image of Jesus. "Then he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out. That's Matthew 12:11. What does this say about how we see sheep?
Once they be risking their lives, they can be stoned to death if they work on Sabbath. Huh?
Well, I don't want to focus on the Sabbath idea, but the idea that if one sheep is missing, the shepherd won't say, I have 99 that I need to take care of. Forget about the one. He will go after and try to find the one. Again, it's an image of how God takes care of us. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains to seek the one that is straying? Matthew 18:12. My sheep hear my voice and I know them and they follow me. John 10:27. John 10:11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. It's all the same idea. Now, I think all of this stuff that I've said so far, you've heard. You know that. I want to give you another point. Look at this reference, Isaiah 53:7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Who are they talking? Who is Isaiah talking about here?
Jesus.
Why is that important? That he did not...
That happened, yeah. Prophesied.
Okay, so when a sheep is confronted with danger, what is his reaction? He suffers it, right?
Can't do much.
Well... That doesn't matter. Most of us would scream. So, using the analogy of the sheep not complaining when it's going to get sheared, when it's going to get killed, it just takes it. And extending that to Jesus. So he opened not his mouth, talking about Jesus. When, at what time was they talking about Jesus? During the crucifixion, right? And here is Philip, when he's talking to the eunuch, using that as a reference. Now listen to this. This is very interesting. Look at Acts 8:32. The place in the scripture which he read was this. He was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Okay? Acts 8:33. In his humiliation, his justice was taken away. And who will declare his generation? For his life is taken from the earth. The very next thing that happens, the eunuch says to Philip, I ask you, of whom does the prophet say this, of himself or some other man? And then in 36 he says, see, here is water, what hinders me from being baptized? Now how did the eunuch go from this story to wanting to be baptized? What's in that story that is so amazing to him?
Phil told him about Jesus.
Right, but what characteristic of what they said about Jesus was so important?
He was a sacrifice.
Do you guys remember a few months ago we talked about the whole idea of honor and shame in Mediterranean culture? The idea that if you are being physically tortured or you are in some kind of distress or pain, if you are an honorable person, especially if you are a man, you do not shout, you do not say anything, you do not scream out, you suffer it, you take it. Okay? This is why this is one of the reasons it's so important. Sheep in the Mediterranean culture were raised by the men, the goat outside. Goats were raised by the women inside. So sheep have an image of being manly, macho, outdoors. It was the man's job to take care of the sheep. Women and goats inside represented shame. Men, sheep, outside represented honor. What Jesus did on the cross by not shouting out was seen by that culture as an incredibly honorable thing. It meant that he knew what he was doing He was going through something that he had to go through. The fact that he never complained, he didn't shout out when he had nails stuck in his hands and he was hanging there for 6 hours, he never shouted. So all of this stuff that you guys are saying about sheep being dumb and following the leader and getting lost, all of that's true, but the side that we're missing, the side that we don't get when we don't understand the culture, is that sheep were an honorable animal. They were seen as honorable. So part of the message that God is conveying to us by calling us His sheep is He is saying that we are honorable to Him. So it's a positive message as well as the negative message that we've been talking about.
Does that by extension lead to the negative connotations of goats?
Well,
satanic?
Yeah, well, it could. I don't know that there's a connection between the goats and satanic in that Mediterranean culture, but there's definitely this division between goats, female, shameful, sheep, honorable, outdoors, manly, male. So by calling us sheep, He's bestowing a title of honor on us as well as all of the other stuff that are characteristics. Alan?
So they were very chauvinistic in that.
Oh, you think? I'm glad we've gotten over that now, though. Now, read this now. We've read this 100 times. Read this with this idea in mind. Mark 15:37, and Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Then the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. So when the centurion who stood opposite him saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." I always wonder, how did he get that he was the Son of God from this? Well, here's at least part of the story. He took it like a man. He did the honorable thing and never complained. So the centurion realized that this must be a special guy. This must be somebody with a mission. This is a man of God. See, it adds, when you understand that little thing, sheep equals honor. And part of the image that you have, if you live in that culture, of sheep is that they don't complain. If you're about to shear them or kill them, They don't say anything, and that's part of the image that God is trying to convey to us. Okay? Genesis 22:13. Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. The ram was such an honorable creature that it was able to replace Abraham's son in the sacrifice. You see how it changes the meaning a little bit when you see that detail. Any questions on that?
I have one on the previous one, getting back to the culture of that time. What was the meaning of a eunuch? I know what a eunuch is. I mean, what was the end here in that story?
I don't know the answer to that. Does anybody know that? You mean, why was it a eunuch?
Yeah.
Probably just a historical fact.
I think the eunuchs were servants to the kings. Yeah.
Important administrators.
Right. Yeah. So they were very important. They had a lot of influence. It would be like being a cabinet member or a vice president or something.
The king would trust him with his many wives.
That could be part of it too. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a culture.
Okay, I want to go to another one. Salt of the earth. When Jesus tells us we should be the salt of the earth. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men. The word savor in the second line is better translated as bad or insipid or not powerful. Yeah, dead. Now,
what?
No,
more savor?
I would think it was good.
Yeah, flavor.
No, lost its savor.
Yeah.
Means it's lost its effectiveness.
Right.
Okay. What do we think of in this culture when we think of salt?
Meat.
Taste. Mm-hmm. That's good. Salt, however, when we think about it in this culture, is almost exclusively used, James. It's a preservative. It's a food flavor. It's a spice.
Also, recently, as a major negative because of its overuse in canned products, et cetera, et cetera, and hypertension.
That's right.
And that time is the major flavoring.
Now here's the question. If they're talking about salt as a food, as a spice in this verse, what does it mean if it loses its savor, if it loses its effectiveness, it's thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot?
Well, you start with the way they make salt. Start with the way they made salt. You scoop out an area and you let the ocean water come in, evaporate. And then you take off the bottom layer. But the more you take that off, the more some of the other non-salty minerals will accumulate. And so when you finally start getting salted, it doesn't taste like salt anymore, you put it on the road. You now dump it in the road. And so what he's doing is he's using that as a comparison, right? So if we lose our savor, then we too are good for nothing but to be cast out.
But let me ask you this. I think he's talking... I'm going to give an alternate one. That's good. I hadn't heard that one before. It sounds to me like they're talking about salt that already exists. If you have a salt shaker full of salt and you let it sit 5 years... does it ever lose its saltiness? If it gets wet, but even then, if it dries out, it's just clumpy, but it's still salty. So how can it lose its saltiness and be good for nothing?
I think he's talking about, he's saying you are the salt of the earth. He's saying you are good people. I think that's he might be using it in that context.
You use the light to the world.
Mm-hmm. But I want to let's keep going here. Does it sound like he's talking about food in this verse?
No.
I don't think he is.
No.
For everyone, this is Mark 9:49. For everyone shall be salted with fire, and every sacrifice shall be salted with salt. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost his saltiness, wherewith will ye season it? And season can mean prepare. Okay? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. Doesn't really sound like food. Mm-mm. Now, salt, this is Luke 14:34. Salt therefore is good, but if even the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is fit neither for the land nor for the dunghill. Men cast it out. Now how? Wait a minute. How can it not be fit for the dunghill? That is the garbage. It's not fit for the land over here. It's not fit for the dunghill here. So it's thrown out. That's very interesting. Isn't the dunghill and thrown out the same thing?
No.
Okay.
If you have a mulch pile, which we do, you wouldn't put salt in your mulch pile. You want leaves, you want grass, you want things that will make a good soil, and salt will spoil the soil.
Okay. Another good theory, Don. Let's see where we go with this. Now, here's a case from the Old Testament where it's clearly talking about salt as food. Can this which hath no savor be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? There's no doubt that we're talking about a seasoning here. Let's step back for a second, though. How was food cooked in the Mediterranean culture? Fire. And did they have an open fire? Did they build an oven?
Both.
Okay. They had clay ovens that they would build, usually outdoors. And the women, with the goats, would cook the food. Don?
Do you understand the
go over here and our snacks this morning were very salty.
Mm-hmm.
You observe that a couple of the snacks were very salty. They did not have snacks like that. They had to buy their salt very precious stuff.
No Twinkies?
And so we have so much salt, I don't bother putting salt on my face.
Yeah. But there's enough salt in it, or in the food that you eat, that you get what you want. That's right.
I'm not sure for them.
Okay. This oven, usually a brick or clay oven, would be on the ground. Maybe some kind of grill or hot plate. The fuel was underneath. Now, what did they use for fuel in these? There was no wood. There was no forest. Okay? If you were a woman in this culture, not only were you indoor with the goats cooking, you were trained from a very early age to make nice patties out of the goat dung and make them little hamburger-sized things and put them out in the sun and let them dry, and that was the fuel for the fire. Now, here's a really interesting thing. If you take a bowl or a plate or whatever is underneath that the dung sits on, and you sprinkle it with, guess what? Salt. It acts as a catalyst in the chemical reaction, and the fire burns hotter. So, when Jesus says, be the salt of the earth, the first thing that this culture probably would have thought of is that salt is a catalyst for the fire, for a chemical reaction. So what he is saying is, be a catalyst for my fire. Let me read you, I'm going to introduce this book in a minute. This is his translation of what this verse ought to say. You are the catalyst in the earth oven, but if the catalyst has lost its catalytic ability or saltiness, how shall its catalytic ability be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden underfoot by human beings. It was not a true catalyst in the sense that it did not sustain the reaction forever. It was used up slightly. So when it was used up, it was thrown out. And that's why there's a distinction in that verse between the dung pile, which was a valuable thing, and the salt, which is thrown out and trodden underfoot, is because salt is valuable for the fire. So it changes the way that we read that verse. You are the salt of the earth. You are the catalyst for the fire that I am. But if the salt has lost its savor, wherein shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot of man. That's how it can be used up, is in the fire. Listen to this verse. It doesn't mean this, but it sure fits. If when you reread these verses, Luke 14:34, salt therefore is good, but if even the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is fit neither for the land nor for the dunghill, men cast it out. Now that makes sense. What's the last line? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So now you just learned something new about how to interpret that. So he's asking us, that's what the salt means. We are to be his, I take it to mean, we're to be his hands and feet and eyes and method of action on this earth. We are the catalyst for the fire. Does that make sense now? Alan.
It may sound like a silly question, but these are metaphors, parables. I mean, they're trying to tell you something, but why doesn't he just say it? Why does he have to talk about salt in the metaphor?
Because in the culture that the Bible was written in, he did just say it. And there's no culture he could have written it in that it could have been written in that would have understood. That would have been understood by everybody everywhere for all time.
So this is kind of a universal way of explaining what he wanted.
Well, it sure was universal for the time. And see, our culture here that we have, Alan, that is individualistic, it's not honor shame based. The culture that we have in this country at this point in time represents an unbelievable minority of how the world thinks. Almost all the world at the time of the Bible, and probably 80% of the world now, thinks more like this. They think in terms of honor, shame. They think in terms of collective mentality. We are the exception. So we're supposed to be going back and learning about them. We assume that we're the way, that this is the way everybody thinks. It's not.
You said 80.
I made that number up. I'm just saying there's a lot. The majority of the world now still thinks in terms of those Mediterranean cultures even back then. That's why it's fairly easy to understand them, because it still exists.
Was the salt not good? Say it lost its flavor, right? It got old.
It means that it no longer would sustain the fire.
Okay, so it has to have the flavor in order to sustain.
Remember, the word flavor means effectiveness. Almost everybody who interprets that word thinks that they're talking about a food.
Well, I would think. I always read that, and I would think that being cast out and into the fire would be hell. That we're no good, so we go to hell. So the dunghill, I don't know if you're saying it's that, but I would think it wouldn't be good for land. It wouldn't be good if it loses its flavor or its effectiveness. It wouldn't be good for either one of those, so it should just go to the fire, hell, kind of. So I don't know.
Yeah.
That's how I always thought about it.
John?
What is sanity in Greek for savor, and what does that Greek word imply? What does it mean?
I looked it up last night, and it has to do with effectiveness or potency.
So potency might be a better translation.
Yeah. Yeah. Natalie?
Alan was saying, why doesn't he just say it? I think it's true. You could have a translation that would update the metaphors and the figures of speech. Maybe Living Bible is kind of make it 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
But by learning it this way, it establishes the fact that Christ was historical. He really came. He was in a particular culture, and so he spoke the language of that culture. And that's important for us to know. It's not a fairy story. He doesn't just fit in any culture. What he says fits in all cultures, but he's rooted in a particular culture and a particular time.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim?
Yeah. Furthering this, at least in my mind, this idea of the loss of potency of salt, which we're talking about, salt itself does not lose potency in terms of flavor or not. But in this case, if you're sprinkling it on the fire, what is left is salty ashes, and that would not be potent. Could not be reused for another one.
That's the idea. Okay. That is the way in which it wears out, is that it no longer acts as a catalyst for the fire. Ruth?
And another reason why they don't say directly is because the Middle Eastern communication style is different. They go around in circles, word pictures, before they get to the point. And women, too, they don't look directly to the person. They kind of look off. There's a shame when you look directly at something or directly get to the point. It's more of an American thing to do everything direct. Unless it's Jesus who's trying to reprimand the Pharisees. That's an exception.
You know, it's interesting because one of the examples that's in this book that I didn't really go into is that in the Mediterranean culture, if you are invited to an event, I say, Carol, would you like to come to the party that I'm having next week? It is customary. Your appropriate response would be, I'll think about it. And then you go away and you gossip about me behind my back, find out if I'm an honorable person, if the party's going to be any good, what's going to be there. And then it is customary for me to ask a second time. For you to answer the first time, or for me to not ask a second time, would be rude. There's a lot of examples of it in the Bible, where questions are asked, nothing is said, questions asked a second time, the answer is given. In fact, the author uses an example of a class he taught where there was a student from Greece, and the student from Greece said, now I know why you Americans have such rude behavior. You would invite me to a party and I didn't say anything, and nobody came back and invited me the second time. So that's sort of like what what you're saying, Ruth, is that it's not a direct. It's not even intended to be answered the first time. And how would you understand that if you weren't from the culture? And the Bible has several examples like that.
There's at least one Asian culture in which they ask somebody something three times before they know for sure how that person has decided.
Yeah, it's the same.
The first two don't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, they're just niceties that are exchanged. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of that is done with a purpose. We look at that and we go, why don't they just answer the first time? Wouldn't it be a lot easier? But there's a whole process that goes on between the first question and the second question that's part of it.
I asked her to go out 10 times and she continually said no.
Well, I think, Alan, what's going on is she comes from a culture where you have to ask 11 times. All right, I'm going to get to my favorite one. I think this is fun. Strike on the right cheek. All right, let's go to Matthew 5:38-43. Jesus is saying, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Let's focus on the second verse, 39. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. The question I'm asking is, why the right cheek? Why not any cheek?
It's meant to use your right hand.
Hang on.
Back flat.
Okay.
Back.
I need for a little display up here. Two volunteers, and since you opened your mouth, you're the first one. Get up here. All right. Good.
I'd much rather clap.
All right, I want you guys to stand facing each other.
Would you like to dance?
Yeah.
All right, John, you've just had a grudge against Alan for a long time. Okay.
Oh, so this is real.
Yeah. I forgot to tell you that part. Yeah, just bear it like a man. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
All right. And you are going to slap Alan on his right cheek. How many?
Al's getting too personal.
Just keep your clothes on. All right. How many ways can you think of that you have to do that?
Well, either my left hand, but okay, that wasn't considered the way to do it. It was the right hand, so it had to be a back slap like that.
Okay, so there's really two options. There's a forward blow with the left hand, or come back and slap with the right hand on the right cheek.
Yeah. Back.
All right. Now, I know you guys have made up. What I want you to do is stand a lot closer to each other. About half that distance.
7 inches for the whole
7 inches. A little closer. Come on. Come on. You guys can do it. All right. This.
That being short is still bad.
All right, right about, I won't make you stay there, okay, because I know how uncomfortable it is, but right about there.
I'm enjoying it.
Is,
honey, help me.
See how hard it is? This, though, is the cultural distance that people stand from each other in a Mediterranean culture. Okay? Now, what do you get when you get this close? You get, you're breathing on each other. In Bible times, probably neither one had taken a shower for at least a couple days, you think. They had bad teeth, their feet smelled. It wasn't a real comfortable thing, but you get used to it. Okay, now, John, you're still intending to hit Alan across the right cheek. Mm-hmm. What options do you have now?
Oh, I do have the left, but...
It's a little harder to come up with your right hand because... Mm-hmm. It's more about like this.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably going to hit him with your left hand, right?
Most likely.
Okay, now, this is your last chance. If you really want to hit him, go ahead. Okay.
He's using a fist.
Thank you.
A slap, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Open hand.
Right. Now. So Jesus was talking about whoever slaps you on the right cheek. So they were standing close together, about 7 or 8 inches, would have hit with the left hand. Now, what was the left hand used for in this culture?
Dirty stuff.
Toilet functions. Okay? Dirty stuff. What were some things you never did with your left hand? You never pointed at someone? You never hailed anybody? You never ate with it? You never gave a gift with it? And certainly, you never touched anybody with it. Okay? Boy, I would have been... Yeah. So, to hit somebody on the right cheek in that culture meant that they were being hit with the left hand. What kind of an insult is that to hit somebody with the left hand? That is the grossest insult. Okay? The maximum insult. So Jesus isn't just saying here, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, like, you know, does something. What he's saying is, whoever insults you as much as it's possible to be insulted, turn the other cheek to him also.
Are you saying that Jesus is implying that was the left-handed slap, the first one, and then he turns the left cheek to him?
Well, then you might hit with the right hand, sure, which is a lesser insult.
But that whole thing goes against human nature. And then Jesus, of all people, should have known our nature. Now, if somebody hits you or takes your cloak, you're not going to give them your other coat or whatever. Or, you know, it's just against human nature, as far as I'm concerned. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
unless they're really, really good Christians, because that time they weren't. They weren't good Christians. What were they going to do?
Dave?
Yeah, but Al is correct. That is human nature, but by Christians, and having a new spirit. That was one of the reasons that Christianity just spread through Rome, is that when Nero, which was the worst person ever, obviously, was feeding the Christians to animals, crucifying them, hanging up, all the different things they did. The Christians didn't fight back. They didn't cuss and swear. They knew their destiny. They knew they were dying as martyrs. And the people in the audience that watched it were just enamored and said, you know, these people are changed. They're different. You know, what could make this person from a coward that would scream and cower to just, you know, take this abuse like a lamb, like Jesus, and make them so different? And so the hierarchy of the Romans, you know, the elite all converted to Christianity because they saw people were different.
But it's that time.
And that's why Christianity just spread and took over. I mean, there's no other culture, no other place like that, where the people that are persecuted for hundreds of years wind up, persecutors become, adopt that religion of the people they persecuted.
That's absolutely right.
Because their behavior was just so radically not human.
Yeah, but at that time, there was no Christianity. I mean, he was still preaching. Right, Jesus was still going around preaching Christianity, and it wasn't Christianity at that time.
Well, you don't have to label it for it to be the same thing. I mean, what he's talking about here is exactly what Dave is saying. He's saying this is typical. These verses are typical of the way all of the world has been for all of history. Jesus comes along and he says, "Let's do something different. Let's be the salt of the earth. Let's be different people." I, Jesus, love you. That let that love change how you respond to other people. So, Alan?
All right. There's a God. And let's just hypothetically say Jesus never came here. There was no Jesus. How do you think this society right now would be? Hypothetically, there's still a God, but Jesus did not come and die for our sins and all that. There was no such thing. Just believe in God, and that's it. How do you think this society right now would be like?
I don't think we'd be here. Yeah, I think as a country we wouldn't exist, because so much of our founding was founded on Christian, Judeo-Christian, but Christian values. I think it would be, I don't know. How do you guess at that?
No creation.
There wouldn't be anything.
Slavery would still exist.
Yes, Natalie.
This is an example of how Christ's wisdom is so much greater than human nature, as he was making a point. Because when you let someone slap you, let your enemy slap you, you diffuse the evil. Usually, if they slap you, I doubt that they would slap you again. You know, all their anger just melts away and is diffused, and so that helps to really make you salt the other side.
That's a great point. Yeah, if someone slaps you with the biggest insult that they can insult you with, and your response is, you know, do it again, brother, you're right. It's going to take 19 people out of 20. It's going to take the steam out of them.
I think that happens a lot to me.
Is that you personal?
Yes.
No.
This is not actually a closed fist situation. It would be like more combat or an assault. Am I correct that this is more of a personal and tends to be an insult? You slap the person. It's not meant to be, let's rumble, let's fight.
It might be. I don't know the answer to that.
Slap is an open hand.
Yeah, it might be a symbolic gesture in that culture that is intended for an insult, but it's certainly, because of what the left hand was used for, it's certainly intended to be as big an insult as anybody could give. Okay. So I want to read this to close. I just want to read this passage again and hear it now in terms of a new understanding of that phrase, slap on the right cheek. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, whoever insults you as much as it's possible to be insulted, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's some of the most radical words ever spoken. It's 12:25. I'm not going to have time to close what I did last time, but I'll do it. I've got a couple more coming up, so we will get to it. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes,
Alan.
Just real quick. In the Torah, the Old Testament, it does say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Correct me if I'm wrong. So when Jesus then comes and says, turn the other cheek, is he not contradicting the Mosaic law? That's what I'm curious about.
Well, it's actually a progression. In the Old Testament, when God said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, what he was doing was ratcheting down the violence. Because what typically would happen was one person, you know, your tribe kills one of my tribe would go in and kill 10 of your tribe. And God was saying, no, one for one, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Now Jesus comes along and he's ratcheting it down again. He's saying, this is the way it used to be, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Now I'm going to take it down even further. Don't return. You don't need to return violence for violence.
But God is supposed to be, he doesn't change his mind. So what I'm saying is, he's going against what God originally said.
The maximum that you can do.
Right.
Was a tooth for a tooth and an eye for an eye. That's the maximum response you should do. And Christ is simply saying, okay, now this should ideally be even your maximum response should be.
I'll answer that in a second. Let me get to Valerie.
Okay, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was actually from the Sumerian, the Code of Hammurabi. And Abraham came from that area, and he transplanted the rules that he was familiar with. So when it says you have heard, it doesn't mean that God actually set that down. You have heard. I mean, this was one of those handed down laws that came from that area.
So it wasn't from God originally.
It wasn't God. It was the code.
It was from 1700 B.C.
Yeah.
Interesting. I got to look into that. Yeah.
That Old Testament?
Check it out and let me know. Jim?
I've heard that it said that when an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was saying that, like if a rich man and a poor man got in a fight or one injured the other, they go to before the tribal council of elders or whatever, they would have to say that the eye of the wealthy man and the eye of the poor man are of equal value to him and same for his food. So they couldn't go, they had to set the punishment commensurate with the crime. And it didn't, and they said two examples, an eye and two, not just one. So you have to, the loss of an eye is much more serious than the loss of a tooth. So you have to make this commensurate.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Regard to their social status.
Valerie?
Yes, there were like 300 of these laws that were all collected by Hammurabi. And some of them actually said, well, the eye of an ox of a poor man is put out compared to the eye of an ox of a rich man. And then there were different payments based on your economic status.
So it was real.
Huh. And there were a lot of eye rules. For some reason, they were really big into the eye.
It came from an older...
Dave?
It's also important, the Bible obviously later on in the New Testament makes distinctions between your personal response and the government. And so it's turning the other cheek. This is not a government law, you know. And the Bible says that, you know, that God establishes later governments to restrain the evil of society, and it's going to have different rules than me personally. So these ones talk about trying to think. There's nothing in here that talks about a judge or a law. This is my personal response to somebody that offends me, and it has nothing to do with the government restraining evil. And so we got to make sure we don't get that confused. A lot of people that confuse that. The same thing with charity. A lot of people think, you know, read the Bible talking about being charitable poor and think, well, that's the government's job. And
it's, right.
Well, no, you know, that's talking about my personal response to poor, not the government's job, you know, to fulfill that great command.
And that's why Jesus' message was so powerful. It was not because it came from a government down. It came from the inside and actually changed the hearts of people, which is a much more permanent thing.
Well, you got the Bible verse.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it says here, Jesus shows that this principle, and I can...
Where are you, Carol?
Exodus 21:24. Hand for hand, foot for foot. Shows that the principle, which was meant to guide judges in assessing damages, was never intended as a rule for ordinary interpersonal relationships in which the faithful should seek to imitate God's own generosity.
Very good. Okay.
But we are here out of time.
Yeah, okay.
But he's right. There was a law of Hammurabi that preceded Yahweh, okay?
It didn't precede Yahweh. Now, wait a minute. Yahweh.
All right, let me close, okay? So, when we study the Bible, it's important to learn about the language. It's important to learn about the history. It's important to learn about the geography. It's important to learn about the climate. But if we don't learn about the culture, we're going to miss a lot of these cool little tidbits like the ones I talked about this morning. So I want to here is a safe assumption, okay? If you think you understand a passage in the Bible and you are using our culture to interpret it, you are probably at least getting it partly wrong and maybe completely wrong. So it's worth it to look into a little bit the culture. That's where I'm going to introduce this book. I got most of these examples from this book. It's called The Cultural Dictionary of the Bible by John Pilch, P-I-L-C-H. And he's just got like 100 little random interesting examples of this kind of stuff. He's got articles on hair and feet and... You look up all kinds of things, and a lot of them don't have to do with interpreting a particular Bible verse, but they do have a lot to do with just understanding how the culture operated. So I got about 4 or 5 different versions of this kind of thing, but I highly recommend it. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.